This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. If you're a woman and you've ever asked for a raise, it probably sounded a little something like this.
In the late 80s, a law school classmate of mine and I were at the same firm, and I found out that he was earning substantially more than I was.
I had had the same position for 7 years, and I had went to my boss one day and told him I needed a raise, I needed a promotion.
I was a paralegal at a law firm for 12 years, and I worked overtime for many, many years and did not get any overtime pay.
As an independent contractor, it's always been hard for me to ask for money.
I waited a few weeks, nothing happened, so I went to his supervisor and waited a few weeks and never heard back.
I went to the partnership to ask for an equity increase.
He said, nah, paralegals aren't entitled to that much money.
And I asked for a pay increase, and they said, oh, no, no, sorry, we can't give that to you.
I ended up going to the owners of the company. Within about 5 days, I was given a raise and a promotion.
I applied for a different position and got it, and it had a higher salary. And then I asked for a counteroffer, which I also got.
And I was the first person and a woman at this company to make that happen.
We're pursuing an administrative audit of salaries to ensure that female teachers' salaries have not been undercut by the structural pay inequality outcomes of the past century.
They can't find the money to give me not even 1% pay rate.
Well, for all the leaning in we do, women still made 82 cents on the dollar in 2017 on average, and women of color do even worse. But getting companies to be transparent about what and how they pay their employees has been a challenge until now. Last week, a federal judge ruled that the Trump administration must comply with an Obama-era rule that requires companies with 100 or more employees to send that pay data to the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission. The big question now is, will better data lead to better and more fair pay? Well, here to talk about this with us is Rebecca Greenfield, reporter for Bloomberg covering gender, race, and class, and host of the Paycheck Podcast. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We also have Emily Martin, the Vice President for Education and Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center, and her organization was part of the lawsuit that sued the Trump administration to reinstate the rule. Emily, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Emily, let's start with you. Why was your organization pushing for companies to report the data?
Well, we think this is a critical initiative for a couple reasons. First, if you are required to provide this pay data to the EEOC annually, that means you have to look at it. That means the company is measuring and monitoring race and gender wage gaps. And if you're giving this data over to the EEOC, which is the agency that's responsible for enforcing pay discrimination laws, you're pretty motivated to make sure that if there is a wage gap, that there's a good reason for it. And if there's no good reason, you're motivated to fix it. It's also really important because pay discrimination is a hard problem to fix because of the culture of secrecy that surrounds pay. So many people are paid less. Many women are paid less than their male counterparts and have no idea because you just don't talk about that at work. And this helps fix that problem by giving the EEOC a window into companies' pay practices.
So I want to turn to you now, Rebecca. I reported on this when it first was announced that there were some questions about whether or not this increased transparency would actually have an impact on wages. Some small business owners were saying that's not the case. It's hard to tell. What's your take on that?
So business owners always push back on this kind of thing. They say it's onerous. They say it's going to cost them money. It will cost them some money. How much is a little unclear. And I think there is an idea that transparency, you know, is the best disinfectant. There has been limited research showing that, but there is some promising research that when this kind of government reporting happens, that the pay gap can decrease. We saw that with a recent study that came out this year that was kind of a first of its kind that showed the companies there who have to report, it helps close the pay gap by a decrease of about 7%. So it can work when you do have the data to know what's going wrong, that some companies might start to fix it.
Part of the problem here also, and Emily, I'm curious to get your thoughts, and part of the reason why we're even doing this segment is because there's been a lot of talk about women not asking. Right? That we don't even ask for the money, that we don't ask for the raises. And we just heard at the top of the show, we heard a montage of all these women who asked with mixed results. Some got it, some didn't, although represented some sort of a struggle to get there. Emily, is it that women aren't asking?
You know, there's some new studies out that show actually women ask as often as men when they're in the same type of job, but women are less likely to get raises when they ask for them. Supervisors often have either unconscious or conscious biases that lead them to react less well when women are seen as difficult, while men are seen as being go-getters in these situations. So it's not as simple as fixing the women. We really have to address the ways in which pay is set and the stereotypes and the biases that can infect pay setting, even if employers don't realize it.
And what's your take on that, Rebecca? Because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce actually did also push back on this rule. And as we said, the business community has said, you know, this is burdensome for them. But does this really help give power to women who are asking for the money and just not getting it?
I mean, this specific initiative is not going to be the cure-all either, because it's just a start. It's just companies having to report to the government. Still, individual women and companies aren't going to have the information that they might need to ask for raises, but there are pushes for that, and this is one small step toward just the idea of more information, the idea of more transparency, which here in the U.S. especially is just not where things have been going in discussions about pay equality.
And can you tell us a little bit about the Chamber of Commerce pushback generally? What were their concerns there?
Yeah, so this is asking companies to give more information than they have been giving before on these EO1 forms. And it is quite a bit more information. And companies are saying that that's going to cost them a lot of money to do that. And, you know, they don't want more red tape and more bureaucracy, which is an argument we hear a lot from companies and all types of regulations. The estimate that the EEOC is giving for how much it will cost them is much less than they're saying how much it will cost them. That's what they're saying the pushback is. I also think that this is just something companies don't want to report or admit. And we've seen this in a couple of ways. Anytime companies have been asked to say what their pay gaps are, they push back. And it's because the numbers can be embarrassing. If they're breaking the laws intentionally or not, they can get sued. So I think there are just these fears that companies have when giving up their data.
Emily, you've seen these disparities in pay data. So these things are real, Emily. What's the concern? How can we actually make this effective?
So I agree with one thing Rebecca said, which is that this pay data initiative is really important, but it's not the whole solution. This is a step towards greater transparency around pay. Greater transparency around pay is a really important cultural shift that we're in the midst of that gives employees more information, more power in the workplace. There are also important efforts going on in a lot of states and also in Congress to strengthen our equal pay laws. So, for example, to make quite clear that employers can't set your pay based on what you made in your last job, because that can allow pay discrimination to follow women and people of color through their whole careers. So this is a piece of a larger culture shift around pay and a real new energy around these questions of equity that I think is exciting. This is the beginning and not the end of those changes.
And I'm wondering also, the Trump administration, Emily, blocked this rule. It's now been overruled. But do we think that the EEOC is actually going to use this information?
I think so. There was a lot of work that went into this rule at the EEOC. And I believe that there are many, many people at the EEOC who are excited to use this tool if it is made available to them. So I am really optimistic that collecting this pay data is going to allow a whole new level of enforcement of our equal pay laws that's quite overdue.
Rebecca and Emily, I'll open this up to you as well. And I tweeted about this yesterday. Ellen Pao tweeted about how she had asked for more money and she was, criticized for it. And I said, it's not that we're not asking. It's that we almost get in trouble when we do. So I guess the question is, for me and for a lot of other women who we heard at the beginning of the show, from our experiences, asking for money is often something that we get a negative response to or we're penalized for. Is there a good way that that should be handled?
Yeah, so, you mentioned that we're now getting the message that women are asking more, but they're not getting as much. And I don't think women should take away from that you shouldn't ask for raises. The studies have found that still some women are getting when they're asking. So women should be asking for raises because if you don't ask, you're not going to get it. But what the studies are also finding is that when women are penalized basically when they really go against the gender stereotypes, that when women act—
when we don't ask nicely?
Yeah. So when you're acting more like a man, that's when you get penalized more. I mean, there are all sorts of coaching sites and ways to learn how to, quote, negotiate better as a woman. I don't think that is the solution to this whole gender pay gap problem. But if you are an individual woman, it does, behoove you to look up some of these best practices because it can help you when you're in this really tricky situation.
That's frustrating. Emily, we've got about a minute left. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that. Do I have to learn how to negotiate better like a woman? Or does the industry have to understand that we can ask for equal pay if we deserve it?
Well, there's definitely some data out which says obnoxious things, like you're more likely to be successful if you smile when you ask for a raise.
I'm smiling right now, just so you
yeah.
know.
So that should help. But I also think that the more that women do ask, the more this is normalized. People's gender expectations shift over time. And so we are all part of the process of shifting those expectations about what is normal and appropriate behavior for a woman. So asking is an important part of that process.
And maybe we don't always have to be nice when we ask. Rebecca Greenfield is a reporter for Bloomberg covering gender, race, and class and the host of the Paycheck podcast. And Emily Martin is the vice president for education and workplace justice at the National Women's Law Center. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I did ask for a raise when I found out the men doing the exact same job as I was were getting 15% more than I was. I was told there wasn't enough money in the budget to cover my increase, so I tendered my resignation, upon which I was given a generous bonus as a parting gift, no doubt to forestall the litigation I might be considering. My name's Barbara, Seattle.
A report last fall from the United Nations outlined drastic effects from food shortages to extreme heat that could be felt by 2040. And this week, officials from around the world are meeting at the 4th UN Environment Assembly in Nairobi, Kenya. It's a gathering of heads of state, business leaders, and UN officials that are meeting to discuss issues from agriculture to waste management to technology innovations and possible solutions to the growing climate crisis. Joining me now is Alexander Kaufman, climate reporter for HuffPost. Alex, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
So what's happening in Nairobi? What are the goals of that meeting? I mean, because a lot of these meetings convene and it sounds like you've got a lot of big names and big people in the room, but is something actually going to happen here?
With any of these meetings, a lot of it is just kind of convening, looking at reports, and trying to find a way in which you can build some sort of consensus across the developed and developing world about how to tackle some of these issues. But probably one of the most important things that is coming up at this meeting and is well-timed to a study that was released on Monday is, this is one of the first big meetings where they're talking about what governance strategies on geoengineering will look like. So geoengineering broadly is the concept of how you can deploy different technologies to impact the climate and potentially reverse some of the effects of centuries of burning fossil fuels that have been heating up the planet. The most controversial of these is a technique called solar geoengineering, which proposes, through a variety of different techniques, essentially blocking out some of the sun's rays and cooling the planet down in that way, or at least halting the warming of the planet. Now, this is proven technology that could work. The problem is that there have been different studies that have come out that say, if you were to suddenly halt that process, you risk having global warming not only reach where it would have been had you not done it at all, but reach it at a more accelerated rate and have it become much more dangerous. Another problem is that it may cool down Mumbai in the middle of a heat wave. You risk the potential that it could cause a drought somewhere in Vietnam. And that becomes a very complicated issue. And considering we can't even agree in any kind of concerted way to lower emissions and mitigate the impacts of climate change, taking on a technology like that involves a host of governance issues.
So we have governance issues, but there are also corporations are going to be here. And what is their role? What are they trying to get out of this? Or what role are they playing in the talks generally?
That's right. So, I mean, big companies generally show up to all of these UN climate summits on the environment. They play a really big role in the Conference of the Parties, which is the annual conference that generated the Paris Agreement in 2015. And they play different roles. I mean, they are there to lobby. They are there as part of some countries' delegations. And this tends to be a really controversial thing between developed countries and developing countries because, you know, you have, for instance, some of these small island nations in the Pacific who feel that it is wildly inappropriate that a country as vast and prosperous as the United States invites an Exxon or a Chevron or another large company that is so uniquely responsible for this crisis to have any kind of seat at the table, much less a seat beside the most powerful and hegemonic country there.
Alex, let's talk about agriculture. What is the focus here? Because we know that certain types of agriculture and food production are really unsustainable and bad for the environment. What are they talking about at the conference?
They're talking about agriculture really broadly. I think it's important to note kind of going into this that, you know, as it is, the food practices that we have for feeding the 7 billion human beings on this planet right now are extremely environmentally taxing, whether that is from the chemicals that are sprayed, whether that's from the tendency to plant monocultures in a lot of places that are rapidly killing out other species of certain edible fruits and plants. Bananas are a big one. And, you know, different irrigation practices in different places are not good. And so at this conference, they are trying to discuss a variety of different ways that can be dealt with. You know, part of it is finding ways to use fewer chemicals on crops. Another part of it is trying to find fresh ways to just educate farmers, particularly in developing countries, about how to more safely grow crops locally in a lot of these places, particularly in places that have rapidly urbanized. You know, I'm thinking like big cities in Western Africa. You know, you have a tendency of people to grow food for sustenance and then water it with water that they're getting that is filled with human sewage, you know, and then you're selling raw vegetables that contain E. coli and other types of bacteria from human fecal matter, and you're causing rapid spread of disease. You know, these things are more for developing countries, but this is also a big thing in developed countries too. I mean, there is a lot of discussion about how we can more sustainably farm food indoors through vertical farming, how we can look into cell-based meat and alternatives to the meat industry, which, you know, around the Green New Deal debate here, we've been hearing a lot more about its emissions and the threat against your hamburgers. And while a lot of that is nonsense, it is very true that meat is a very large emitter, and the practices around raising meat in an industrial fashion are undeniably cruel.
And what about plastics? Because this is something we've talked about here on The Takeaway. We covered how China in particular has stopped accepting a lot of plastics mm-hmm. for recycling. Has there been a lot of focus on this, what this really means, or are we just hearing a lot of bluster so far?
The answer is both. There has been a lot of focus on this, and this, I think most people recognize that this is probably one of the most tangible and visible impacts of our sort of consumption-based economy for the past century. You know, the bigger crisis now, as you pointed out, is the fact that China has closed its doors to waste from other countries. And now that China has closed its doors in an effort to kind of clean itself up, you're seeing these impromptu landfills that are developing all over Southeast Asia. So the problem hasn't actually been dealt with in any kind of substantive way. There has been a movement for a long time, particularly in these kind of elite circles at Davos and elsewhere, for things like the quote-unquote circular economy, things that either mean that you'll have companies giving you packaging that you can reuse, which, again, puts the onus on the consumer and the individual.
But is it up to us, or is it really up to the companies to say, we're just going to stop selling all that? Because I keep thinking about the tension between, like, one of the notes I have here is, where does our responsibility begin? And where do the responsibility of these technologies kind of take over, right? At what point, or do they have to be concurrent? Do we have to do both things?
No, I mean, I'm a firm believer that they're individual environmental action is not actually something that can make any kind of substantive difference. And if anything, what it does is it alienates regular people who, then feel like the act of caring about the planet that we are bequeathing to our children is some type of elite concern. There needs to be some kind of concerted effort by the adults in the room and by the regulators to say enough is enough and we're not going to allow for this kind of wasteful consumption and packaging anymore.
Alexander Kaufman is a climate reporter for HuffPost. Alex, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure.
Eight years ago, Japan was devastated by the most powerful earthquake to hit the country in more than 100 years. It created a 43-foot-tall tsunami that killed nearly 16,000 people and also knocked out the power at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. It was the biggest nuclear meltdown since Chernobyl in 1986. 8 years later, people are slowly trickling back into the region, but the cleanup could take another 40 years to complete. Roger Chang is the executive editor of CNET News, and he traveled to Fukushima in November to cover the cleanup efforts. Roger, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote about the reminders of the disaster everywhere. I was a kid during Chernobyl. We're still talking about it in many instances. So what did you see in Fukushima?
You know, little things and big things. I mean, driving through the areas near the towns that are near Fukushima Daiichi, you can see they're still ghost towns. A lot of the houses are still barricaded with metal gates. We actually hopped some of those gates and we walked into some of the stores and shops there, devastated by the tsunami and the earthquake. And really, you could sort of see the imprints of what things looked like 8 years ago. Like, you can still see clothes on some of the mannequins in the retail stores, but they're all abandoned. And it's crazy. And just nearby, I think one of the more stark reminders of the disaster, bags of radiated dirt, hundreds of bags piled up everywhere that they can't really get rid of at this point.
Well, I want to get back to that in a second. Yeah. And so far, we understand, you said you're describing a ghost town, basically, but there are some people who are back.
Absolutely. The town's a little further away, I'd say about 15 to 20 minute drive outside of Daiichi. You could definitely see life trickling back in. The police station was open. This local supermarket was open. I did see people there. But it's kind of in spurts, and it's still very industrial. The main highway going through Daiichi, largely it's construction vehicles, it's trucks, really for the cleanup effort. There aren't a lot of signs of normal everyday life.
You mentioned the dirt and the bags that you were seeing, the radiation that's still there. Is it even safe to be there right now?
It's debatable at this point. Okay. I'd say Japan and Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, would argue that the surrounding area is relatively safe at this point. But there are those stark reminders. And interestingly, when you're driving down the highway, you'll see signs that show the radiation level every several hundred meters or so. To be fair, the radiation level there is lower than it could be, I guess. It's still higher than it is, say, in Tokyo, but it is, I guess, within sort of a safe zone. Mm. Just interesting, like even the daily weather report on the local TV station, they always include the radiation level in the area.
Speaking with Roger Chang about cleanup efforts in the wake of the Fukushima nuclear disaster 8 years later. Roger, you mentioned TEPCO, who's the company that owns and operates the plant that failed. They're saying that the cleanup despite all these, you know, small changes we're seeing now, could take up to 40 years.
That's correct. It's been very slow going. It's been 8 years, and really only now we literally started scratching the surface of the problem. Just back in February, they finally sent a robot into one of the reactors, Unit 2, which is actually the most radioactive of the three reactors. And for the first time, was actually able to pick up and hold a pebble within the core of the reactor. And that's how far they've gone in 8 years, is that after a lot of failure, they finally got one of these robots in there and actually touched a pebble. But that's it. And that sort of gives you a sense of the magnitude of the problem, of like how much more that they actually need to get through to clean up these reactors.
What about prevention? Has TEPCO laid out any plans for that so that there is not another disaster like this?
Well, not so much, but only because they've shut down all of their power plants. In fact, I think all but 11 nuclear power plants are shut down, including all of the TEPCO plants. There's not even a discussion to turn those things back on. And so TEPCO isn't really focused on prevention at this point. They're focused on cleaning up Daiichi, which is a massive, massive problem.
One of the most important issues, it appears, is the one of contaminated water. What's happening there and how easily can they contain it?
So that, I think the core problem, I think the dirt is a very visual, graphic reminder, but what you don't really see is the amount of toxic water that needs to be cleaned up and collected. And they can't do anything with this water. They actually just have to store it. And so for the last 8 years, they've been storing a huge amount, 1.1 million tons of contaminated water sealed up in 900 tanks on the facility. It's mind-boggling. And it keeps leaking. So imagine a leaky bucket that you constantly have to keep collecting the water and storing it. And so they estimate they have enough room to hold about 270,000 tons of water, which would take them through sometime next year. And then after that, they run out of space.
You said it keeps leaking. That's concerning to
yes.
me, that it's leaking back into the environment.
Yes. So this is the issue, that there are leaks. Well, one, some of the water needs to be routinely cleaned out because it's the water used to cool the fuel rods. But there are leaks at the bottom of these reactors. What they've done basically is to create this ice wall, and I kind of profiled it in one of my pieces. They've kind of created an ice wall around the reactors to harden the ground around it, and basically prevent the toxic water from leaking out and the groundwater that's flowing from the mountains in the west from going in. So they've tried to reduce the amount of water, the toxic water being generated, but it's still a big problem.
How do you even contain something like water? I mean, obviously we're talking about how, but like really, right. How? I mean, are they clear that they've gotten all of the contaminated water? Is there potential for there to be more given these leaks and the dirt that we just discussed?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've done a pretty good job of collecting the water inside. Again, like they've created multiple barriers to kind of prevent the water from going out to sea. I'm sure there's some leakage, but they've actually done a lot to at least prevent the water from leaking out. And they've got facilities on the grounds that actually are designed to treat some of the water. And they've actually managed to get they've gotten 62 out of the 63 contaminant elements out of the water, but the last one, tritium, is because it's genetically bonded, is really, really difficult. And so the water is still technically deemed unsafe by the government, by every regulator out there, and so they've got to store it all.
Wow. Roger Chang is the executive editor of CNET News. Roger, thanks for this update.
Thanks for having me.
All right, everyone, that's all we've got for this Tuesday. But remember, we're on all the time. Hit us up on Twitter at The Takeaway, hit me up at Tanzina Vega, and, well, follow both of our accounts. And one more note, The Takeaway will be broadcasting the next two shows from WKSU Studios at Kent State in Ohio. So if you're hanging out in the Buckeye State, we hope you tune in. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.